Today is Monday, October 26th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, record numbers of people have voted early in the U.S., but there are also major legal challenges to the vote.
I've covered five presidential elections, and I've never seen so much contentious events going on and legal challenges to voting and voting rules and regulations.
Also ahead, COVID-19 cases surge in Europe.
The major outbreaks are Spain, Italy, and France.
Plus, Chileans vote to scrap their country's constitution. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where nearly 60 million people have already cast their ballots in the elections. With 8 days left until voting finishes, that's more people voting early than did so in the entire 2016 election season. But despite the record numbers, there are numerous factors getting in the way of people trying to vote, ranging from health concerns related to the COVID-19 pandemic to efforts at voter suppression. For more, I spoke to VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins. Chris, can you give an overview of the challenges to the vote that are taking place this year?
Well, I mean, I've covered five presidential elections, and I've never seen so much contentious events going on and legal challenges to voting and voting rules and regulations. I mean, it comes amid a pandemic in which people are concerned about voting and their safety by going to the polls. So we've already seen 60 million people have voted via mail-in and early voting, and there's been tremendous lines. I think a result of that is they don't have as many poll workers on hand to handle the demand of people wanting to vote early. So you've been witnessing long lines across the country during early voting.
Now, this is also the second U.S. presidential election since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down in 2013 a key section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Can you explain what that section was and what its removal means?
That section that was removed made it a requirement that certain states or jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination in the past, in the 1950s and 60s, places mostly in the South like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, they were having to obtain pre-clearance from the U.S. Department of Justice before they could make changes to voting practices and procedures. And this was designed to ensure that the right of everybody to vote would be carried out. But the Supreme Court in 2013 said that that was unconstitutional. And some critics have said that has led states to further disenfranchise voters by changing rules that directly impact minorities.
And what are some of those changes that have taken place in this election in some of those, especially southern states?
First of all, there are 35 of 50 states that have strict voter ID laws that require you to show up at the polls with a government-issued ID. This impacts mostly minority and low-income voters who might have a hard time obtaining an ID. There are other laws in Texas, for instance, which say that there's only one mail-in drop box available in each of a Texas county. If you look at a place like Houston, Texas, and Harris County, Texas, that's a population of about 4 million people, and there's only one drop box in that county to handle those voters. There are other issues regarding curbside voting, and this comes at a time when a lot of voters with disabilities choose to go to the polling places, pull up in their car by the curb, someone hands a device to them, and they can vote right there in their car. But it turns out that the Supreme Court ruled last week that Alabama state officials can prohibit curbside voting. And again, it impacts people with disabilities, especially concerned about going into a polling place with the coronavirus pandemic. And then I just might mention one other thing. Transgender voters, a study was released earlier this year that basically said as many as 378,000 transgender voters would not be able to vote because their name or looks don't match their identification cards. And if you're going to a state that requires you to show an identification, a lot of transgender people without those IDs in 35 states might not be able to vote.
Even so, we're seeing record turnout in early voting. Are these changes actually impacting the vote?
It remains to be seen the exact impact, but voting rights advocates say that these challenges and these decisions by the courts to limit voting and change voting rules impact minority voters the most, just in the number of transgender people who might not be able to vote. That could have an impact, especially in battleground states that the margin of victory or defeat is just several thousand votes. Voting rights advocates that I've talked to say in that case, most transgender people vote Democratic. And so if they're disenfranchised or they're not able to turn out in big numbers, that could help the Republicans and Republican nominee Donald Trump.
That was VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins. While people try to get their ballots cast, the candidates spent the weekend hoping to sway the remaining undecided voters. For more International Editions, Lori London spoke to VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
I spent Saturday traveling with the Joe Biden campaign. The former vice president focused on the state of Pennsylvania and got a little bit of star power assist at his second drive-in rally of the day in a swing county in a battleground state when John Bon Jovi, the rock musician, showed up and performed. But in general, the Biden campaign, at least with Joe Biden, has been playing it very cautious. He is doing nowhere near the number of appearances that President Trump is. It is definitely a socially distanced campaign. The Biden campaign has other ammunition in its arsenal, such as former President Barack Obama, who was in Florida also on Saturday, and will also be back again there early this week. And he has shown that after 4 years, he still knows how to wow a crowd. Now, of course, Lori, the president has had no difficulty at all attracting big crowds, thousands of people turning out at these rallies in swing states, much to the chagrin of some of the officials in these localities who have called the president's rallies super spreader events, fearing that they're going to cause wider outbreaks of COVID-19 in their communities at a time where in many states we're seeing an upswing again in the number of cases.
Both candidates seem to have very stark differences in how they are handling it or addressing it.
Yeah, absolutely. The president, of course, still saying on a daily basis that we're rounding the corner, even though the number of cases and hospitalizations go up, where Joe Biden is blaming the president for many of the deaths we've had in the United States, saying that the Trump administration has never had a plan. And now we're seeing public statements from people such as Mark Meadows, who's the White House chief of staff, telling media on Sunday that basically we're just going to have to let this thing play itself out and hope to combat it with therapeutics and an eventual vaccine, but not calling for stricter policies on social distancing and masks. And Joe Biden has said if he wins, as soon as he gets in as president, he will call for a federal mask mandate for all public transportation and urge governors of states to utilize mask mandates.
With just over a week to go, is there any chance that there could be potentially any sort of so-called October surprise that could actually impact the outcome of the election at this point?
One thing you need to keep in mind, Lori, 60 million people approximately have already voted. So any sort of October or early November surprise is not going to change their votes. Where we're really seeing a focus by both campaigns, because most voters are really already committed to one of the candidates, it's more about rallying your base and ensuring that the people supporting you actually do early voting or mail in their ballots or show up on election day. So I don't think any sort of October surprise is going to sway somebody to change their choice of candidate, but it could have an impact on either motivating them to go to the polls or stay home on election day.
That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaking to International Edition's Lori London. More on the U.S. election. Texas is the second largest state in the U.S., and it used to be a Republican stronghold. But that is changing. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains why Texas is turning purple.
In rural Carnes City, Texas, ranchers and farmers are firing up their tractors to caravan for Donald Trump. Tracy Gendrish is riding his tried-and-true tractor.
It's an old dog, but it's probably a 78 or 80 model, 40 years old, you know. But it's still running like a baby dog.
Gendrish's great-grandfather moved to the U.S. from Poland. His family has been farming ever since, and he's always been self-employed, just like Trump.
He's an independent businessman. He's not a politician, you know. And I love what he's doing.
More than 380 kilometers south at the Texas-Mexico border city of Brownsville, Democrats are revved up for Joe Biden. David Betancourt, whose grandparents are Hispanic, says he disapproves of how Trump has handled his presidency.
Donald Trump is just a very self-centered human being. It's obvious, and I think we're all kind of tired of that.
The political parties on both sides of the presidential race are highly mobilized in a state that had been a model of Republican conservatism. 1976 was the last time Texas supported a Democratic presidential candidate. But the dynamics are changing in the second largest state in the country, says University of Texas government professor Jim Henson.
This year in 2020, you can actually see a path for Biden to narrowly win the state.
Texas is deeply divided between the red Republican rural regions and the blue Democratic urban areas. But the bridge between the two areas, the suburb, is changing Texas politics. The communities outside the urban centers used to be Republican strongholds, but they are turning purple due to nearly a decade of rapid population growth, economic development, and migration.
As people from California, from other parts of Texas, from the cities that were close to those suburbs that moved out looking for better schools and cheaper housing, as all those people moved around, a lot of them settled in those districts, and they changed those districts.
Minorities such as African Americans, Latinos, East and South Asians make up the faces of many suburbs. The different ethnicities, as well as whites, lead to a greater mix of political beliefs. In addition to the voters in the suburbs, the Latino vote is another factor. While the majority of Latinos consider themselves Democrats, in some cases, Republican candidates in Texas have earned more than 40% of the Latino vote. Voter turnout among Latinos, especially in the border towns, has been a challenge for the Democrats. Jared Hockema is the Democratic Party chairman in Cameron County.
If Mexican Americans and people who live along the border can be activated and they go out to vote, that has a tremendous impact on the outcome of an election.
But Republicans at this parade, including one of its organizers, Sean O'Brien, do not think Texas will become a Democratic state.
I don't think it's ever going to turn blue, but yeah, purple maybe.
A polling average shows Trump and Biden essentially tied in Texas. Henson says the Republicans and Democrats are doing everything they can to mobilize people to vote in hopes of making a difference in the Lone Star State. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
This is VOA. Thailand's parliament has begun a special session amid daily pro-democracy protests demanding the prime minister's resignation. Opponents of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-Cha urged him Monday to stop using the monarchy to justify his hold on power. Prayut rejected a demand from protesters to step down and said last week it was his government's job to protect the monarchy. Airstrikes on a camp in northwest Syria run by Turkey-backed rebel fighters killed at least 20 people Monday, a rebel source said, Reuters reports. the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which monitors the war in Syria, gave a higher toll at 78 fighters dead and nearly 90 wounded, the AP reports. Both the observatory and rebel sources suspected the airstrike was carried out by Russia. The airstrike comes a week after Turkish troops evacuated one of their largest military bases in the area, which Syrian government troops had surrounded for months. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. COVID-19 cases are surging in hotspots around the world. In the U.S., new infections topped 82,600 for both of the past 2 days, the World Health Organization says. Figures from Johns Hopkins University show the U.S. has averaged nearly 800 deaths a day for the past week. As new cases rise, a top aide to President Trump said Sunday, quote, "We're not going to control the pandemic," end quote. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows made the remarks as several people in the office of Vice President Mike Pence tested positive for the virus. Much of Europe is also seeing record numbers of new cases. In Russia, infections surged to over 17,300 today. Authorities said 219 people had died in the past 24 hours, pushing the official death toll to 26,269. Spain had over 20,900 cases on Saturday, the highest in a single day so far. Spain had 231 deaths, the most since mid-May, the WHO said. Italy also had a daily record over the weekend with 19,000 new cases Sunday. There were 151 deaths, the most in over 2 months. France had over 45,000 new cases Sunday, also a record. But the head of the scientific council advising the French government on the pandemic says the true figure may be closer to 100,000. For more on the case surge in Europe, I spoke to journalist Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, why is this surge taking place?
Health officials seem to put it down to the fact that people are indoors more now. People are staying inside, windows are closed, they're not going out for as many walks as they were. Plus, people are moving around a lot. There aren't very few restrictions on movement within Europe and within individual countries.
And how are different countries responding to the rise in cases?
The major outbreaks are Spain, Italy, and France. And of course, over the weekend, we saw France and Spain pass that milestone in each of their countries of 1 million confirmed cases. Here in France, you're still looking at regional overnight curfews, as well as closures of bars, so as people can't just go in there and sit and chat and stay within a confined space. In Spain, we've had the state of alarm come into effect, and that allows the government to impose certain measures, and they've already brought those in. Overnight curfews, restriction on movement of people, restrictions on big numbers of people mixing together. Italy, we've also had that. Restaurants and bars to close at 6 p.m. at night. Family gatherings restricted. Cinemas, theatres, gyms, swimming pools, all those closed for the next 4 weeks.
Are hospitals getting overwhelmed again the way they did in February, March, or April?
They are indeed. The impact on hospitals, not just here in France, but also in Belgium and the Netherlands. And I'll give you a figure here in the Greater Paris area. You've got 65% of intensive care patients are suffering from COVID. That means that if anything else happens, there just isn't the capacity anymore for the health service to be able to deal with that. When that first spring wave came through Europe, it was generally only affecting two or three countries. So France in particular was able to move some of its patients to Germany for treatment there. But now that there are more cases in Germany, that's closed. So there is no more expansion. On top of that, they really do not have any more doctors and nurses. So you can't go out and manufacture an increase of 10, 15% trained medical healthcare professionals.
And in Paris, how are people reacting to this new surge and to the renewed restrictions?
To be honest, in the last week since the curfew came in, you've felt that autumn is here. The mood has changed along with the weather. And there is a feeling now that despite this talk of a possibility of a vaccine early next year, it's going to be a long winter. And you really get the feeling that everyone has to bunker down. Everyone has to get their head around the fact that this may be a winter like Europe hasn't experienced in our generation.
That was journalist Catherine Field in Paris. In Chile, voters moved one step closer to changing their constitution this weekend. Reuters' Brian Wood reports.
Chileans poured into the country's main square Sunday night after a majority voted to draft a new constitution. Over three-fourths of voters have chosen to scrap the country's dictatorship-era constitution in favor of a new charter written by citizens. As votes were counted on live television, spontaneous parties broke out. Drivers honked their horns. Others banged pots and pans. It was a full circle moment for protesters who gathered here just last year, demanding social reforms. Many Chileans expressed hopes that the new charter will guarantee more equal rights to healthcare, pensions, and education.
If it were not for the brave young people who fought for us, no one would have gone out onto the street. I wanted this to happen for a long time, and it happened, and thanks to them. Today we win.
Fireworks rose above a crowd of tens of thousands of jubilant people singing in unison as the word rebirth was beamed onto a tower above in Santiago's Plaza Italia. The flag of the country's indigenous Mapuche people was seen flown proudly as they will seek greater recognition under the new charter. President Sebastián Piñera, whose approval rating plummeted after protests escalated in 2019, said from now on, they should unite behind a new text that can provide a home for everyone.
Today, citizens and democracy have triumphed. Today, unity has prevailed over division and peace over violence. And this is a triumph for all Chileans who love democracy, unity, and peace.
Four-fifths of voters said they wanted the new constitution to be drafted by a specially elected body of citizens, made up of half women and half men, over a mixed convention of lawmakers. Members of a 155-seat constitutional convention will be voted in by April of next year. They will have up to a year to agree to a draft text, with proposals approved by a two-thirds majority. Chileans will then vote again on whether they accept the text or want to revert to the previous constitution.
That was Brian Wood of Reuters. That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Poliomyelitis, or polio, is a paralyzing and potentially fatal infectious disease caused by the poliovirus. Poliovirus invades the central nervous system and can cause total paralysis in hours. It can affect people of any age, but children under 5 are especially at risk. Polio can be prevented by vaccines, but it is not curable once someone is infected. In 1988, the World Health Assembly vowed to eradicate polio, a disease responsible for more than 350,000 cases of childhood paralysis a year across 125 countries. USAID's contributions helped secure the eradication of wild polio in the Americas in 1994, the Western Pacific in 2000, Europe in 2002, Southeast Asia in 2014, and most recently, this year, Africa. In mid-August, Africa was certified wild polio-free after 4 years of no new cases. Nigeria was the last country to meet the rigorous standards of certification, joining 46 countries in the region to celebrate this historic public health milestone. Today, polio cases have been reduced by 99.9%, and only Afghanistan and Pakistan continue to experience endemic cases of polio. In many countries, the road to polio eradication has not been easy. Protracted conflict, misinformation, displaced populations, remote communities, and other challenges have stalled and continue to stall the efforts of countries trying to combat the virus. Nonetheless, if residual transmission of the virus is to be stopped, a sustained and evolving response must continue. Only through the unwavering dedication, creative problem-solving, and incredible hard work of local communities, national governments, and global partners alike has a polio-free world moved within reach. In partnership with these countless health workers, community leaders, and volunteers who have never lost sight of reaching every last child, USAID's support towards global polio eradication has helped ensure over 400 million children are vaccinated against polio each year. Today, nearly 19 million people are walking who would have otherwise been paralyzed, and more than 1.5 million people are alive who would otherwise have died from polio. This year, 2020, is a notable one to celebrate World Polio Day, with the Africa region certified wild polio free, even as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to disrupt essential healthcare worldwide, including routine immunization programs. Moving forward, USAID and its partners plan to use the lessons learned and infrastructure built on the road to polio eradication to inform our response to the current pandemic and future infectious disease outbreaks.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.